So previously in our study of the reign of King Hezekiah, we started in 2 Kings 18, and we looked at the first eight verses of that chapter, and as it, particularly, especially, I guess, the first seven verses, where he was telling us about the beginning of his reign and how Hezekiah did trust the Lord above all that were before him or after him of the kings of Judah. And he clave to the Lord and departed not from him, kept his commandments, and walked and did right in the sight of the Lord like David his father. Well, we don't have the northern kingdom around anymore, as we saw that it had fallen there in 2 Kings chapter 17, or that's where we read about the fall of it. So it was at the beginning of that when that Hoshea's reign and that siege came upon Samaria, when the tribes were then carried away and that kingdom fell and then Judah was left alone. It's in that situation that Hezekiah comes to the throne of Judah, and recalling also that his own father Ahaz had been the most wicked king that Judah had ever had up to this point. And so he had a wicked father, was brought up in a wicked household, and was surrounded by wickedness. That's what Judah had fallen into. Their brethren to the north and those 10 tribes of the north had long been overtaken in wickedness, and that's why that kingdom fell. And so that's what is going on, at least that's the spiritual atmosphere or climate that Hezekiah grows up in. And as we've mentioned before, I believe all of us, if we were looking at that background, what was going on in his nation, among his people, and then particularly in his own family, with what he was brought up with, would we have predicted that someone brought up in that situation during that time in that family would have become one of the most righteous people that we read about in the scriptures, that had a trust in the Lord that was rare among mankind that's ever lived? Is that what we would have expected to come from that? I don't know. Well, I certainly wouldn't have. I don't know if any of you would have expected such somebody like Hezekiah to come from the background that he did. But of course, that does show us and remind us that it is the responsibility of each and every one of us to seek our Maker, and we all have that responsibility. Nobody has an excuse to say they didn't know that they had a Creator that they should seek. That because of their wicked family or wicked nation that everybody else is to blame for them not seeking their Creator. Nobody has an excuse for not seeking to glorify God as God. And Hezekiah reminds us of that. And that even among the most wicked families, there can be somebody that decides to seek their Maker. We can see Hezekiah was brought up with all of that wickedness, saw that, and saw the Lord's work and punishment of it, recognized that it was God's punishment of all that evil, and then he decided he wasn't going to follow those ways, that he was going to seek the Lord to please the Lord so that he wouldn't, and his kingdom wouldn't partake of those punishments like it occurred in his own lifetime with the kingdom of Judah under his father, and what happened to the northern kingdom there from the beginning of his reign. So he very consciously chose to reject the evil ways that he saw all around him. So that is an uncommonly good reaction to that situation that Hezekiah had. And so he became king now and is choosing to follow the Lord, which means he's going to have to repudiate and reject and oppose and try to undo all of that work, all of that evil work that his own father had done. As part of that, as we began our study of 2 Chronicles chapter 29, just to refresh, verse 1 says, Hezekiah began to reign when he was 5 and 20 years old, and he reigned 9 and 20 years in Jerusalem, and his mother's name was Abijah, the daughter of Zechariah, and he did that which was right in the sight of the Lord according to all that David his father had done. He, in the first year of his reign, in the first month, now this is where we, as we start verse 3, this is where we now follow the information that we have in 2 Chronicles, and this is why we've left behind our studying of 2 Kings chapter 18 for a time, because this is telling us what happens at the very beginning, the very first actions, the very first works that Hezekiah did after becoming king. And it's only recorded here in 2 Chronicles chapter 29. The events that are recorded in elsewhere in 2 Kings concerning Hezekiah are going to be events that occur after this. So as we're trying as closely as we can to follow chronologically these events that are recorded in these books, just to try to keep it straight, that's why we're going. We've gone over here to 2 Chronicles 29. So let's keep in mind now as we're looking at this, this is what Hezekiah does immediately after he becomes king. And it really does remind us of the one that in the preceding verse, in verse 2 here in 2 Chronicles 29, that Hezekiah is compared to as far as his obedience to the Lord. He did what was right in the sight of the Lord, like whom? Like David, his father had done. Now, if the Lord was going to compare you to somebody and speak of your obedience to him in comparison to somebody, would David be a good one to be compared to? How many among men could God choose to compare somebody to in their righteousness that's going to be better than David? I mean, we're looking at somebody that God said was a man after his own heart. So we have some of these ones in the scriptures that God identifies as, certainly as gives us as part of that great cloud of witnesses of those who believed and obeyed him. There's some among them, though, that God gives some very special descriptions of particular, specific to them, that we just don't see him. He'll give them, give certain ones an honor in their description that he reserves for them. I mean, we think of Abraham. What did God say about Abraham that is different from what he said about anybody else? And we know that Abraham had a faith that was greater than, well, he was described as the father of the faithful. Anybody who has faith in God is going to be walking after the example of Abraham, who had faith in God. And he's called the father of those who had faith in God. But more than that, what did God call him? Abraham was called the friend of God. So when we think of Abraham, we think of somebody God said, he's my friend. We think of David, and there's somebody that God said, his heart is like mine. When God says things like that about somebody, I mean, that's obviously, those are examples we want to look at, that we want to emulate, that we want to follow as examples. So when he says of Hezekiah, he did what was right in the sight of the Lord, like this one that I've identified as having a heart like mine. That's not a small thing, as we would know, for Hezekiah to be described in that fashion. But what did, when we read about David, when David became king, what was the very first action that David took as king? This is, I know you'd have to go back to 2 Samuel chapter 5 or 1 Chronicles chapter 11 to read those events. Now, again, when we talk about, well, when did David first become king? That's a more complicated for David to answer that question than for anybody else that was ever king and over any of the tribes of Israel, because David was anointed king three times. The first one was in 1 Samuel 16 when the Lord sent Samuel to Bethlehem after he had rejected Saul, when Saul did not destroy the Amalekites like God said. And so then at that point, as the Lord said in 1 Samuel 15 through Samuel the prophet, he said that the Lord this day has rejected you from being king over Israel. Well, so then God had chose a different one that back in 1 Samuel 13 he'd already foretold would be the next king of Israel, a man that was after God's own heart that we know was David. And it was in 1 Samuel 16 that God sent Samuel the prophet to Bethlehem and anointed David to be king. And then he gave his spirit to David and took it from Saul. So from what God had determined right there at that point in time between 2 Samuel chapters 15 and 16, he rejected Saul as being king when he didn't destroy the Amalekites, took his spirit from him, gave it to David, and had David anointed king. So by those actions, God had made his choice. So in the sight of God, who was king of Israel from that moment forward? David was. I mean, David was regarded by God as being the true king of Israel then. Now, it took men a lot longer to recognize or accept what God had already determined, but that didn't change the fact of whom God recognized to be king, and David understood that. When David went to was with his men when he was running from Saul, and when he went and the high priest and was ate of the showbread and was given the sword of Goliath, and when he came there, he said, "I'm on the king's business." Well, he was running from the so-called king. So was David lying? I mean, Saul had not sent him there. He was running there to get away from Saul, to escape from him. But when David said, "I'm on the king's business," well, in that sense, he was minding his own business, wasn't he? He was the king. He understood that when he was on the king's business, he was the king as far as God had determined and anointed him to be. And David understood that. It just took some time before anybody else went along with or accepted it. Now, many people knew what God had said about that. That's the reason Saul was seeking to have him killed. We know that Abigail mentioned what she had heard and knew what God had said about that, that David was king. Also, we know that Jonathan did, and that's why Jonathan made that covenant with David. And Jonathan, who was the heir to Saul's throne, actively helped David in preparing for him to be that king that God had chosen him to be, even though that meant that was at the expense of Jonathan being king, and from that standpoint. But Jonathan understood what the will of God was, in that way, his heart was knit together with David's. They only cared about the will of God and following it. But it was after Saul's death then that Judah, the tribe of Judah, anointed David to be their king. But then the rest of the tribes, with Abner, the captain, Saul's captain, having then anointed Ishbosheth, the remaining son of Saul, to be king. And he propped up the house of Saul. And for 7 years there was civil war in Israel. And the house of Saul got weaker and weaker. And David's grew stronger and stronger. And of course then when you get to 2 Samuel 3 at that point, Abner decided finally that he was going. And he even mentioned that. He knew what God had said about David being king too. He had been actively fighting against it and resisting it for several years. But he finally decided to back David and what God had chosen, and then was actively working to have the other tribes of Israel to then accept David as the king over the whole nation. And that work that Abner did helped to accomplish that. Of course, Abner didn't see it to its full fruition because what did Joab and Abishai, David's cousins, do to Abner? Because Abner had killed their brother Asahel during that time of warfare between the house of David and the house of Saul. Well, Abner had killed Asahel, even though he had warned him not to pursue after him, and Asahel ignored the warning and then paid the price. Abner ended up being murdered by Joab and Abishai. But then after that, Ishbosheth was killed, and that was the end of the house of Saul as far as that was the last of his sons. And then at that point, all the tribes of Israel anointed David to be king. That's in 2 Samuel 5, 1 Chronicles 11. And what was the first action that David took as king when he actually held the reins of power? Before that time, before everybody in Israel had accepted him, even though he was king before his own tribe accepted him, was David even safe in Judah? He was running and hiding, and we read about him being there in the wilderness and of Ziph, and the Ziphites betrayed David to Saul. They were all aware of what Saul had done to Nob, the city of priests, at that time when they had helped David, and he made an example of them. And no other town would give any assistance to David. They did not want to be destroyed. If Saul was going to destroy a city of the Lord's priests, would he hesitate to destroy any of the other towns or villages that helped David in any way? They all knew that. There was a purpose to that wicked action that Saul took, and it was effective, at least for its time, of having the people, even in David's own tribe, to be too fearful of Saul to render any assistance to one of their own, David, that had a name in Israel that was of his reputation, that was honorable before all. But his own countrymen betrayed him over and over and over again. Of course, God did not allow that to succeed in having Saul kill David as he was trying to do. But it does remind us even of his own tribesmen. David could not function as king even until the people accepted him to as their king. And so that started first with his own tribe, and then the rest of the tribes followed suit. And what was the first action that David took when he actually had possessed the authority with the support of all the nation as king, as their king? He conquered the Jebusites, which was on the border. Jerusalem was on the border of the boundary for the tribal lines of the territory of the tribe of Benjamin and Judah. Now, which side of the line? You go back to Joshua when it was divided by Lot, and you look at the distribution of that. The Brook Kidron right outside of the walls of Jerusalem was the actual border between Benjamin and Judah. Jerusalem proper, the city proper, fell within whose territory? Benjamin, that's right. Who was the leader of the tribe of Benjamin until David became king? Well, Saul. Saul was a Benjamite. That just goes to show you, what could David have done? Now, what was the problem in Jerusalem? It was not even called Jerusalem. It was known as Jebus. It was the city, the capital city of the Jebusites. Well, the Jebusites were among those seven nations the Lord had told Israel to utterly destroy, giving that commandment back to in the time of Moses. So for 500 years, through the entire history of the Judges, and through the entire 40-year reign of Saul over Israel, the Jebusites occupied that city right there on the border of Benjamin and Judah. Now, what could David have done about that during those years when Saul, a Benjamite, was the king of Israel and was pursuing David's life every day? Could David get an army together and go attack a city that was in Benjamin's own borders to take possession of it? I mean, that's no way. And then when he was king, anointed king by his own tribe of Judah, what was he going to be able to do as far as taking any action in Benjamin, which was the home tribe of the rival king that he was in a 7-year civil war with? He couldn't do anything there. He couldn't do anything about the Jebusites being in Jerusalem until he was king over all Israel, received as such. And not just by God's designation, but for all the people to anoint him as such. But when he was, when they received him as their king, and he now had the full authority to function and act as king over all Israel, the first action he took was to conquer Jerusalem and get the Jebusites, destroy them and get them out of there. I mean, that was a blight right in the middle of Israel. You have a capital city of one of those nations that God said to utterly destroy, and they had not obeyed that commandment. It was, here was a 500-year example, exhibit of their disobedience to God, their lack of full obedience to his commandments. How did David regard that? Did David recognize that as a blight on their record, such as it was? I mean, he recognized that was an awful reminder of what they had failed to do in terms of carrying out the will of God. David understood that. Now, who was the one that should have done something about that? Well, the Benjamites should have done something about that, going back to when they had conquered Canaan. So, the Benjaminites. Chief among all of those of Israel were bearing the shame of the existence of the Jebusites right there in their midst. Well, then when Israel becomes a kingdom and they have a king, and their first king is from that tribe of Benjamin, why did Saul let the Jebusites for 40 years when he's king, why did he let them maintain their capital right there in the territory of his own tribe? Well, he didn't have faith in God. I mean, that's why when Goliath was there in the valley defying God and the armies of Israel, where was Saul? He was on that mountaintop with his army, cowering in fear. And he didn't go face Goliath and do anything about that. He didn't do anything about the Jebusites. But as soon as David became king, that's the first thing he did. So the first action David took was to, and actually, what was the second action that he took? Right as soon as he took Jerusalem and made that, destroyed the Jebusites, made that his capital, called it the city of David, what's the next thing he did? Brought the Ark of the Covenant to the city, to his city. I mean, all of his actions from the beginning was to right the wrongs, was to correct their errors where they had not been obeying the Lord, where they had been disobeying him. And the Jebusites existing right there, that was a shame. And David fixed that first. And it also was a shame that the Ark of the Covenant had been sitting there in Kirjath-Jearim for decades. The tabernacle had been destroyed back in the time of when Samuel was in his early years as the Lord's prophet, when the sons of Eli were there, those wicked men were killed. The Philistines defeated them and took the ark, and then the Lord plagued them. And they sent the ark back, but there it sat. I mean, the tabernacle was not fixed. And the ark stayed there in Kirjath-Jearim for decades, and predating the reign of Saul, but throughout his reign, Saul did nothing about that. So for all those years, for some 80 years or so, the better part of a century, the Israelites were unable to obey the commandments where God told them to go to where the ark was, the Ark of the Covenant was in the tabernacle 3 times a year for the feast days. Could they observe any of those commandments? While the ark, there was no tabernacle, the ark was over there at some guy's house in Kirjath-Jearim. I mean, what could they do? I mean, it was a hindrance to Israel being able to serve the Lord like the Lord commanded them to do. So as soon as David gets the Jebusites out of Jerusalem, makes that his capital, and then he brings the Ark of the Covenant there and obtains God's authorization for a temple to be built. So everything David was doing from the moment he became king was trying to fix what the spiritual problems were in the nation, to be able to enable all of the people of Israel to be able to obey all the commandments of God. That was his concern from day one, and every action he took was towards that end, and remained that. That's how it started, and that was the history of David's reign as king over Israel. That's what he did for 40 years as king. Well, Hezekiah trusted the Lord and followed in the steps of David. And so as we have that reminder of what David, his father, had done as king, and from the very outset, what do we see Hezekiah doing? It says in verse 3, back in 2 Chronicles 29, verse 3, he in the first year of his reign, in the first month, opened the doors of the house of the Lord and repaired them. Well, what had been the problem there before then? Well, what had happened in the previous chapter in 2 Chronicles 28, verse 24, when Ahaz was king? What did it tell us there? That Ahaz gathered together the vessels of the house of God and cut in pieces the vessels of the house of God and shut up the doors of the house of the Lord, and he made him altars in every corner of Jerusalem. And the Lord's altar, remember what Ahaz had done with that? He took that from the house of the Lord, and he had that joined together with that copy from the blueprint of that that altar to the idols that existed in Damascus that he saw when he went there and had to give obeisance to the king of Assyria that he had pled with to help him, as he gave the king of Assyria all those treasures from the house, from the Lord's house. So, I mean, by Ahaz's actions, I mean, he's giving away these treasures of the Lord's house that were to be used to serve the Lord. Those were the holy vessels. You remember what happened to Belshazzar when he was king of Babylon and took of those vessels of the house of the Lord that Nebuchadnezzar had taken from Jerusalem. Nebuchadnezzar had sense enough to lock them away there in Babylon. But what did Belshazzar do with those vessels from the house of the Lord that were holy to God, to be used, reserved? And that's what holiness means, set apart. Those vessels were set apart for the service of the Lord to worship Jehovah. And what did Belshazzar do with those? Use them for a feast and to worship the gods, so-called gods of silver, stone, and wood, and all those, everything. So a drunken, idolatrous feast, and he brings the Lord's vessels in to be used for that occasion. And what did that get him? The handwriting on the wall and his removal from the kingdom and from this earth that night. But these holy vessels to the Lord, what regard does he have for them? He'll just give them to the king of Assyria, or cut them up in pieces, or take the Lord's altar out and join it to a copy of an idolatrous altar that he had seen and was impressed with. And so what does he do with the temple itself? I mean, he's stripping of it of all of these things that were to be there to serve the Lord with. And he's got all his altars all over town. And what about the Lord's temple? What does he do with it? He just shuts the doors and locks it up. I mean, nobody's even going there. And so what is the first thing that Hezekiah does when he becomes king? Action number one. Well, it should remind us of David. I mean, David conquers Jerusalem, has the Ark of the Covenant moved there, and starts making preparations for the building of the temple so that there would be that place where all Israel could come to be able to serve the Lord like he commanded them. Well, here's the temple that's been shut up and locked. And in his first year, first month, he opens the doors of the house of the Lord and repairs them. And that was an action his own father had taken. So he's reversing what his own father had done. So he's not just correcting a wrong, but in this case, all of these wrongs he's correcting from the outset are the actions of his own father. But is Hezekiah, was his father Ahaz his master, or was God his creator his master? We can see who Hezekiah chose as his master. It was not his earthly father. It was his heavenly father. And so then the next thing, verse 4, he brought in the priests and the Levites and gathered them together in the east street and said unto them. So here are these priests and Levites. Now, what had they been doing for all these years up to now? What had they been doing? What should they have been doing, and what had they actually been doing? Now, how many of them were doing the works that God had commanded them to do as the priests and Levites? I mean, they were supposed to be attending at the Lord's altar at the temple that's been closed up, using the vessels that have been broken up, and the altar that has been taken out of there and made a part of an idolatrous altar in Jerusalem. Had they done anything to oppose that? Now, one might argue, well, that's maybe there were some righteous ones of them, and they just were, they had no power to resist Ahaz, or, well, whether it was because their faith was weak and they weren't minded to do the Lord's will, or if they were fearful, whatever the reason, I mean, obviously they've not been carrying out their duties as priests and the Levites for how long now? We know it's been years. So when Hezekiah has the temple opened and the doors repaired, then he's getting these priests and Levites, and he's going to set them back on the right course. They're the ones that need to be. I mean, Hezekiah, he can't be functioning in their capacity. He's the king, but he's not authorized to be there in the temple. One of his forebears, as we know, Uzziah, had decided he, being king, could do whatever he wanted and went in the temple, and the Lord struck him with leprosy. Hezekiah couldn't go in and into the temple. He's of the tribe of Judah. He's not authorized to do these things. He's now designating the ones whom the Lord had chosen and authorized for these works to now do the works they're supposed to do. So he gathers the priests and Levites together into the east street and said unto them in verse 5, "Hear me, ye Levites, sanctify now yourselves and sanctify the house of the Lord God of your fathers, and carry forth the filthiness out of the holy place." Well, had the house been set apart for the Lord's use, or had that ended under Ahaz's reign? That had ended. So that house needed to be sanctified, and it needed to be set apart for the Lord's use. But notice what he said before he told them to sanctify the house. What did he tell them to sanctify? Themselves. They needed to get themselves right. They hadn't been doing what they should have been doing. So he's calling on them, number one, you need to get right with the Lord. You need to get back to doing what God has commanded you to do. And so he's first of all commanding them to sanctify themselves, get themselves right with God, and then they needed to get to immediately do this work of getting the temple ready so all the people could be serving the Lord like they should. Those are great instructions that we can see there in verse 5 from King Hezekiah. And it's all for the aim of having everybody in his kingdom, and he's responsible now as king to have his kingdom and his subjects to be serving the Lord. Well, how are they going to do that if the priests and Levites aren't, and if the temple's locked up? So he starts with the first things that need to be done. He's got his priorities exactly 100% right, like David had. Verse 6, he says, "For our fathers have trespassed and done that which was evil in the eyes of the Lord our God." And of course, he's not just speaking of our generic fathers, their forebears. I mean, in this case, it was their immediate forebears And when he says our fathers, what about his very own father, Ahaz? I mean, he's including himself in this, and it's 100% true and accurate with his very own father. They had trespassed and done what was evil in the eyes of the Lord, their God. So he's not accepting himself from this situation as being the child of ones who have not been doing right. So he's pointing out all of this wickedness was done by our fathers, and the fact that it was their fathers didn't make it right, and they needed to make things right with their God. So they had done what was evil in the eyes of the Lord our God, and he says, and have forsaken him, and have turned away their faces from the habitation of the Lord and turned their backs. Now, was he speaking the truth? Is that what they had done? It's exactly what they had done, including his own family, as we've noted. Verse 7, also, they have shut up the doors of the porch and put out the lamps and have not burned incense nor offered burnt offerings in the holy place unto the God of Israel. Now, did Hezekiah's own father Ahaz, did he have a hand in that? Of course he did, as we read. What about these other priests and Levites? Did they bear any responsibility for these commandments of the Lord not being carried out, these commandments that God had chosen them and designated them to do? They were responsible too. So Hezekiah is putting the blame where it goes. It's on all of them. But they needed to do something about it now. And verse 8, he says, wherefore the wrath of the Lord was upon Judah and Jerusalem, and he had delivered them to trouble, to astonishment, and to hissing, as you see with your eyes. Well, Hezekiah was there, and he had seen what the Lord had done during the reign of his father Ahaz, and the enemies that came against them, and the captives that were taken away by them. And he says that in verse 9, for lo, our fathers have fallen by the sword, and our sons and our daughters and our wives are in captivity for this. So that had happened to their, and he's talking about specifically Judah and Jerusalem that he mentions there in verse 8. Of course, he also knows what's going on now at that very moment he's speaking those words, what's happening to their brethren in the north. I mean, they're being besieged by the Assyrians as God's punishment for them for their wickedness. So Hezekiah is recognizing all of these actions being the actions of the Lord. They're not just happenings. They're not just things that men are doing. These are things God was doing, and God was doing it to punish them for their evil. And he recognized exactly what it was. And he knows there's only one fix for that. And that's to make right what was wrong, repent, and to then obey the Lord. So he understands this properly, and he's... We can see he's fully determined to have this done and to do it right. And so he says in verse 10, now it is in mine heart to make a covenant with the Lord God of Israel, that his fierce wrath may turn away from us. My sons, be not now negligent, for the Lord hath chosen you to stand before him, to serve him, and that you should minister unto him and burn incense. So he's reminding them of the job that they have and who gave it to them, and to not carry it out, he says that he gives the word to it. That would be negligent. When God has given you a position, and if you don't use that position the Lord has given you, and to do the Lord's will with all your might, then what are we being? We're being negligent in our service to the Lord. Now, of course, we can draw lessons, and we need to draw lessons from that, because we all have, every one of us, the Lord has in particular places, and not just geographical places, that's part of it, but there's certain positions we have, jobs we have, places where we live, communities that we live in, neighbors that we have, and people that we are around in whatever way, and either regularly or just wherever we happen to be at any given time. I mean, the Lord is the one working all things, and we have a responsibility as the Lord's disciples. I mean, what is our overall grand responsibility existing in this world? We're to be the light of the world and the salt of the earth, aren't we? Aren't we to shine as lights in this world, as examples of disciples of Christ, followers of Him, those that are seeking to be conformed to His image and are growing in that? I mean, that's what we're here to be. That's why we're in this world. And so if we aren't doing that in any way, at any moment in our lives, then what are we? I mean, each one of us is in a unique position or place. I mean, I don't know all the people or see all the people you do, and I mean, that's true of all of us. We all have a specific situation that the Lord has put us in around certain ones, and we can't be all of that for everybody. We have to all do that ourselves, and in being what the Lord has put us in a position to be. But we need to remember these words that God, and understand that God is the one that's working in all things, and we better not be negligent in whatever situation the Lord puts us in and opportunity He gives us to be examples, to do good to all men, especially those of the household of faith. Whatever it is the Lord has, wherever He puts us, whatever He gives us to do, we need to be mindful that He's the one that's put us there, and in that situation, whatever that is, we need to be carrying out the Lord's commandments and being an example of one of His followers in that, and not be negligent at any time. Well, what about if everybody else is being so wicked, and we're really going to stand out if we are trying to follow Christ? I saw some, I think we've all seen footage of what's happened as far as the Supreme Court decision about abortion a couple days ago, and I think we've probably all seen images of people that are very, very angry about that and upset. And but when they show footage of these different protesters, and several people had signs that says, America is not a Christian nation. I mean, that was now from their standpoint, what they're saying is somehow this is trying to enforce Christianity on the nation to not have abortion as a federal right for everybody to do that. But anyway, to see that kind of for people to write that and carry that, hold that up as in signs, but making that, saying we're not a Christian nation, we're not a Christian nation, we don't want to be a Christian nation. That was a rejection of even that thought of, well, here's Christ over here, and here's what we associate with following Christ, and we don't want any part of that. We don't want this nation to have any part of that. I mean, that was the point of view that was being expressed there. I mean, we see that. I mean, in our time, I mean, wickedness, there's just so much more of that that's so bold and blatant out before us. And we know that following Christ today, well, just coming in, I mean, I did a little handiwork on our site since, I don't know when it was because I've been away for a couple weeks, but somebody had folded. This was not somebody that just kind of ran over. Our sign got bent out there by the road and one time, and I presume in that case somebody may have hit it with their car and run over it because it seemed to be bent like that. But I mean, maybe somebody bent it over with their hands, but this looked very purposeful. I mean, the corners of the sign were bent over where you could not read Church of Christ. It was bent over to obscure the name. The pole wasn't bent. It was turned, but I mean, it was folded down where it covered up Church of Christ on there, very deliberately. I'm not sure when the last couple of weeks, when that occurred, if that was in the last couple of days or if it was last week or week before, but anyway, it was, it certainly appeared very intentional that somebody took the sign where it is identifying Christ and we're trying to obscure that. And that's kind of thing, that kind of climate that we're in now. And it could get a lot worse, but for us to openly associate ourselves with Christ and his name, and that we identify ourselves as followers of him, that's becoming more and more out of season. And yes, that will make us stand out more. I mean, the more we follow Christ these days, our light's going to shine a lot brighter. I mean, it's not, as the world becomes darker, our light should be brighter. And the contrast should be very clear. But of course, that does invite persecution, and that may happen. That may be part of why these people, these priests and Levites, have been negligent. I mean, it certainly was not in season under Ahaz for them to stand up and say, this is the temple of the Lord to be, this building is dedicated to the Lord for his service and all of these vessels. And like Joshua, as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. Had there been such boldness among God's people during Ahaz's reign, it seemed to be very, very much absent during these years. Well, Hezekiah is pointing that out. My sons, be not now negligent, for the Lord has chosen you to stand before him. Well, hasn't he chosen us to stand before him? And remember, as we're drawing this connection with this lesson even more plain, these priests and Levites that they had were for this physical nation of Israel, and the Lord chose a priesthood to foreshadow what? This is a shadow of the spiritual kingdom of God, which we are, his church, and we are the spiritual and royal and holy priesthood. And we can read in Malachi when he was speaking to those priests and their negligence during those years. And then he makes that prophecy and when he's rebuking them in Malachi chapters 1 and 2. But then the prophecy comes at the beginning of chapter 3 when he was going to send. There's a prophecy of John the Baptist and then the coming of the Lord who was going to be purging the sons of Levi, that they would make their offerings in righteousness. And when he was going to sit there with his, as a refiner of fire and fuller soap, when he was going to be purging and purifying and conforming his disciples into his image, he's describing that work as being his work on those children of Levi. Well, who's he speaking about there? Who are the sons of Levi? That's us. We are the spiritual Levites, his holy and royal priesthood today, all of us. We are the ones that the Lord has chosen to stand before him and to serve him. And we're the ones that are to be making these spiritual sacrifices as his holy temple. That's what we're in this world to do. And we need to do that and not be negligent. So what we read in their failures, let's think about ourselves and the position the Lord has put us in and the responsibility we have in this wicked world. They lived in a wicked time. Ours hasn't gotten as bad as what theirs was under Ahaz. We don't know what the future holds, and we need to be praying it doesn't get like that. But the direction it's already gone in just a few short years is not good. But we need to be standing there, not negligent, but ready to do the Lord's will and be doing that, even though it's going to cause us to be persecuted when we do that. And the Levites have a good response to this. They carry out what his commandment was. Verse 12, then the Levites arose, Mahath, the son of Amaziah, and Joel, the son of Azariah, and the sons of the Kohathites, and of the sons of Merari, Kish, the son of Abdi, and Azariah, the sons of Jehalaleel, and of the Gershonites, Joah the son of Zimma, and Eden the son of Joab, and of the sons of Elizaphan, Shimri and Jael, and of the sons of Asaph, Zechariah, Mattaniah, and of the sons of Hamari, Jehiel and Shimei, and of the sons of Jeduthun, Shemaiah and Uzziel. And they gathered their brethren and sanctified themselves. So they did what Hezekiah told them to do, start with yourselves. They did that. and came according to the commandment of the king by the words of the Lord to cleanse the house of the Lord. And the priest went into the inner part of the house of the Lord to cleanse it and brought out all the uncleanness that they found in the temple of the Lord into the court of the house of the Lord. And the Levites took it to carry it out abroad into the brook Kidron. Now they began on the first day of the first month to sanctify, and on the eighth day of the month came they to the porch of the Lord. So they sanctified the house of the Lord in 8 days. And in the 16th day of the first month, they made an end. And then they went into Hezekiah the king and said, "We have cleansed all the house of the Lord and the altar of burnt offering and all the vessels with all the vessels thereof, and the showbread table with all the vessels thereof. Moreover, all the vessels which King Ahaz in his reign did cast away in his transgression have we prepared and sanctified, and behold, they are before the altar of the Lord." So they come back with their report. Hezekiah gave them the task, and they didn't, as we might say, lollygag about it. They got on it, and they were diligent, and they gave their all to it. How long did it take them to get it ready? They got this done in 8 days. So for them to do what they did in that time frame, they weren't wasting time. They were not being half-hearted about it. They gave themselves fully to it. They sanctified themselves. And we can see that they were sincere and diligent to carry out this commandment. And that's a reminder, again, of what the Lord can do with those that are seeking to serve him. Later on, we could also remember the example that when they were rebuilding, when they rebuilt the temple, rebuilt the walls of the city under Nehemiah. How long did it take them to get half the wall done in Jerusalem under Nehemiah? 52 days. Can you imagine that? Half the wall, or half the height of it, all the way around the city of Jerusalem in 52 days. That was everybody working together with all diligence. That's what the Lord was able to do with his people when they all came together, all of the same mind, putting themselves fully to the task. That was the Lord's work. So what the Lord can do with his people when he gives us the opportunity, and if we respond to that and our mind is to do his will and to do it fully with all of our might, all of us together, what can the Lord do with us if we're like that and have that mind? The Lord can do wonderful works, and if he could do something like that with these people in 8 days, or like he did in Nehemiah's time in 52 days, we don't want to be the one to hinder the Lord by saying, he can't do all of that, and that would be too much too fast, and be the ones to put limits there. So we need to do whatever the Lord gives us opportunity to do, and do it fully, and trust the Lord to work it out, and God can certainly accomplish wondrous things when he has his people that are ready to do it. We're going to stop there, and Lord willing, we'll pick it up there with Hezekiah's response to this in verse 20 next Lord's Day, Lord willing.